I'm Kim, I'm an addict. This morning, I was speaking with a friend, and I told her, I can't imagine going to Wisconsin tonight and standing in front of my fellows and friends and sharing. And that's because the last 16 months have given me a lot of challenges. And so I've been thumping along with these challenges. And she said to me, just be honest with those people. They're your friends, they're your fellows. And so I'll start with that. So be patient with me tonight, thank you. First of all, I would like to thank the Sunday night strength group for having me here. And don't they put on a lovely event? They host this. I've been here many years. Food is awesome. The fellowship is awesome. Thank you so much. Rick in the back, thank you for asking me to speak tonight. So, let me start off by saying that I'm extremely blessed tonight. Some of you that may have heard my story in the past, I talk about my son, my child. And I'm blessed to have him here tonight. Seth and his wife, Ashley, have joined us tonight. So I'm very, very blessed and grateful that you're able to be here. Thank you. They just got married. So thank you. So I might change up some of the stories, because some of you have heard some of the stories about Seth. But anyway, let me just tell you that everything I know about myself today is a direct result of being in the program of Cocaine Anonymous and working the 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the pamphlets and books of Cocaine Anonymous. I didn't know anything I'm going to share with you tonight. I didn't know any of that 30 or 40 years ago. Had not a clue. But today I do, and it's a direct result of working these steps. So what I can tell you in a general way, what it used to be like and what it's like today, and everything in between, and I'll condense it. I'm originally from Wisconsin, born in Milwaukee, raised in Greenfield. Yeah. And that was a very wonderful time in my life. It was very grounded. My neighborhood, my family, my church, my school. So for the first 10 years of my life, I lived in Wisconsin. My father was transferred to Illinois, and and we packed up and we moved. And what I know today is that that ended up being a very traumatic time in my life. Even though back then I thought I was, 10 years old, we're resilient, and I had a loving family, and we settled down yet in another nice neighborhood and went to nice schools and became involved in our church. But it was very hard because I left this safe environment in Wisconsin, or, home, and went somewhere else where I had to sort of start all over, re-identifying myself amongst my peers within my neighborhood. And that is when it started, the thinking problem that we know about today. Because all I really wanted was to be a part of and belong. I wanted your attention, affection, and approval. And although I didn't drink and drug at the age of 10, I did a lot of other questionable things. I also found safe places to find my way to be accepted. And when I speak about my mom and dad, my dad, Army National Guard, brought me up with awesome ethics, morals, and principles. And my mom, I often refer to her as the healthy codependent. If there's somebody left over here, if there's such a thing. But she was. And so, I had those two wonderful people. I had a brother. But somehow, you know, I just never really felt like I was a part of, that I belonged. And I went on this journey of, you know, playing the flute and playing the cello and being in different clubs in school. And, you know, I was a great chameleon. I did whatever I needed to do to fit in. Except I didn't do drugs or alcohol because I had those two entities in my life, mom and dad, you know, pretty much reassuring me that that's not the road you want to go down. Although my father will tell you the story of when I was 2 years old and took a sip out of his martini glass and I went, more. And he thinks that's when it all started. But so, you know, as I trudged along, I just never really felt a part of. I had that feeling that, I never had, you know, the right clothes or the right makeup, the right Barbie doll. I was just always constantly trying to fit in. And I just wasn't really feeling that emptiness inside. When I was in high school, it was student council and physics club, from one end to the other. Baton club, dance club. During the school year, I hanged out with the rah-rahs, and during the summer, I hung out with the burnouts on the corner. Yet, I did not drink or drug, because that was bad. That was very bad. So, fast forward a little bit, high school, my fair share of drunks. Off to college, tried pot, never really could understand the attraction. Never really got into that. I met my son's father in college, and when we got out, we got married. And to be honest with you, some of the attraction, although I loved him very, very much, some of the attraction to my first husband was the fact that he came from an upper-class family. And I was attracted to some of that lifestyle. And I thought, you know, that's going to get everybody to like me. They're going to like me. And, you know, maybe in my own mind, my perception was that things were going pretty well. And they were, for the most part. Until one night I walked out, we lived in an apartment, we had a one-bedroom apartment, and we did quite a bit of, you know, young people's, you know, weekend entertainments and with other couples, and we had friends over, and I walked out, and there on that glass table were my husband and my two best friends. They were doing lines of cocaine, and such a gasp came out of me because I was like, oh my God. There's an illegal drug in my house. And so my husband at the time said, do you want to try this? And I said, no, I do not. And I marched off, you know, into the bedroom and tried to gather myself and walked back out there, and they're still doing lines. And so this one gal, the wife of the other couple, she's like, are you sure? You'll be okay, just do a couple of lines, it'll, you know. Like, no. The third time, I can't even tell you who asked me out of those three people there. They said, we're gonna get ready to go. Are you sure you don't wanna do just two lines? And so what kicked in is that moment of wanting to be a part of, belonging, attention, affection, approval. And guess what I did? I did two lines, just two. That was pretty good stuff. I like that. So we went out. My husband was rather successful in his line of business, and he had invested in a band, and we went to see the band and had a blast on those two lines. And before the night was over, I was looking for more, and there was none. But that was the beginning of fixing feeling right, feeling a part of, with something outside of myself, a substance. Now, during, you know, the next year or so, the progression of drug use jumped, significantly. You know, remember when a gram used to last, like, I don't know, a week or 2 weeks? No? Okay, a week, maybe a weekend. The quantities, we needed more. We always needed more. And instead of starting on Friday night, we all know this sort of story. Instead of starting on Friday night, we'd start on Thursday night. Instead, then it was Wednesday night. And instead of getting up and being present and available on Monday morning, we were hungover. You know, we passed out, we came to, and we tried to function. It became the unmanageability and insanity of it all was, do we pay the rent or do we buy cocaine? Do we pay the utilities or do we buy cocaine? Yeah. Do we go to a family function or do we hang out with the people that are gonna do cocaine? And I'm pretty sure all of you know what the choice became. There was only one choice at that point, and that was to do cocaine, and to do more and more and more, to the point that my husband was dealing cocaine. That was pretty awesome. There was always cocaine in the house. And so that was just it, you know, the unmanageability, you know, trying to pay Peter or take from Peter to pay Paul, and trying to catch up with, you know, family events and the lying, the cheating, the thieving that went on mentally and emotionally between each other and with our families and friends. Now, mind you, started using, gosh, well into my 20s. So there's a part of my mind that recalled what it was like before using cocaine. And at some, you know, little trigger went off in my mind that this was not right, how we were living. You know, we tried to do those normal things, you know, we bought a house. We decided we should start a family and clean out for a couple of months, try, and gosh, if I had my period, it was like we were off and running for 48 hours, and then it was clean out another 2 months. And we did. We had Seth Michael. Yeah. And, you know, I stayed clean during my pregnancy. And, you know, just to give you a little background, he was sick when he was born. And so there was a great deal of concern and fear when he came home from the hospital. He spent some time in ICU. And so I thought that, you know, would keep me grounded and not pick up again. But I would say 2-3 months after he came home, his dad and I were going out with family or friends, I don't recall them. He said to me, do you want to do a couple of lines? Just two. I learned my lesson from the last time, and I said, yes, I do. The progression of drug addiction, obsession of the mind, the allergy of the body kicked in is tenfold than what it was prior to being pregnant. And so when they tell you that your disease is still with you, That's absolutely true. It's, what do they say, doing push-ups while we're sitting back thinking that we got sobriety. It's waiting for you to be weak. It's waiting for you to struggle. It's waiting for those challenges. And that's what happened, you know. I deserve that after everything I went through. You know, I had to stay clean and sober during that pregnancy, and I had to, you know, manage, you know, bringing my son home and taking care of him and being more concerned about, you know, the fears and his little life. And so I deserved that. To the point that, certainly didn't know this then, but over a period of time from 1985 to 1989, I personally had a $20,000 a month drug habit. It's a lot of cocaine. It's a lot of empty hours. My son mastered the VCR in 18 months. Why? Because I was hungover, I was still using. It's a difficult time, you know, what we do to our friends and family when we're using. And it became horrible. You know, the insane things we did. You know, I remember buying a Christmas tree and it sat in the garage. You know how you let it sit somewhere so the branches fall? Like till, you know, January 2nd? There was years the tree never made it in the house. There were family functions that we never made it to. Cocaine became more important than, you know, than anything. As a dance major in college, I gave that pretty much up. Gave up making love to my husband, made too much fucking noise. Sorry for the language. We didn't attend family functions. I remember at Christmas, we told my parents, oh, we're so sick with pneumonia. You know, so my mother, the healthy codependent, shows up. We're hungover from the night before, you know, and she's like, we're on our way, and I'm running around the house and wrapping things in newspaper and plastering bows on stuff. It became really bad to the point that towards the end, I called my parents. Oh, well, let me back up just a little bit. Someone called my parents anonymously and told them, your daughter and your son-in-law are drug addicts. Well, little Miss Army National Guard came marching up to the house and demanded to know what was going on. And I said, well, you don't understand what's happening to my life. And 2 weeks later, I called them and I said, you know, you need to come and get Seth and I. We need to get out of here. And we packed up, you know, I packed up the car and I took Seth to live with my parents. And before I left the house, I packed every vial I could and took him with me. And within 2 days, I was making, you know, pretty much every other day a run to get my cocaine from the house. Yet we were living with my parents because of the cocaine and drug problem. And, you know, through this, I had been to a couple of evaluations at a treatment center, and you know what they wanted me to do, check in, really. And so I was living with my parents, and I think they caught on that I was using. My father had a blood pressure machine for my mom, and one night at dinner when I'm like tweaking out trying to eat, my dad's like, let's take your blood pressure. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. Long and short of that, I went yet to another evaluation. They wanted me to go into treatment, and I said, no, I'll go to outpatient. And so I went home, or went back to my parents, and had a huge fight with them, because they wanted to know everything that happened. And I packed all my stuff up. I packed my boy up and all of our stuff, and I went back to live with his father. He didn't want us there. We were interrupting his agendas. And I want to say that was like December 27th of 1988. And from that day until January 3rd of 1989, it was endless cocaine. Seth wasn't there. He went to Aunt Sherry's house. And we were on this binge, you know? And in the beginning, like New Year's Eve, it's like people want to be around you because, well, you know, my husband had the drugs. And once they saw that, we just could not stop, you know? We were hovering over it. We never left the room if anybody else was in the room, because if we left the room, they might take our stuff. And just the insane things that were happening. The paranoia was horrible. You know, who crawls down the hallway of a second floor house from one bedroom to another because, well, I was afraid someone might see me walking around my house at 3 a.m. We had, in the house in Northbrook, we had a cloak. Talk about paranoid. We had a closed circuit camera on the front door. Anytime somebody rang the door, it lit up a screen in the master bedroom. A little, you know, TV. So you could see who was at the door. But if nobody was at the door and you wanted to look at the front door, you could touch a little button, it would light up and show you the front, you know, the front entry and the driveway. And so imagine being just tweaked out of cocaine and flipping that camera on and staring at the damn thing for hours, you know? See, we're laughing because this is the insanity. This is the insanity. You know, and my husband would go, "Do you see that? Do you see that?" I'd be like, "Where? Where? There's a shadow on the driveway. Yeah, I think that's the tree, you know?" Oh my gosh. You know, I remember we had skylights in the bathroom and the master bedroom in that house, and my husband often said, "Oh, there's somebody up there." I'm like, at 3 a.m? You know, but that sets off that thinking problem. So you're convinced somebody's on the roof at 3 a.m. So anyway, we're at January 3rd, 1988. My sister-in-law is calling me, "Are you gonna come and get your kid?" And I realized I was dying, that my husband was dying, and I called my mother, because she said, you know, when I left her, well, that's another story. She didn't say much. But I do know that, you know, at one point she said, "We're always here for you." So I called my mom, and I said, "You need to come, and you need to come and get Seth, because we're dying here. And he can't be here when we die." So my parents came and to get Seth. And of course they weren't leaving without me. And thus began that journey for me of maybe just a little clarity. 24 hours of sleeping helped. And so when I had that little bit of clarity and, you know, they thought maybe treatment was an option, I said, well, maybe what I need is a nice long weekend at a hotel where I can just clear my head. You know, I had a very dear friend who said she'd come and get my son, and I just think that's what I need. And my parents being unaware of addiction, you know, my father went off to make, you know, a hotel reservation, and I went off to find as much cocaine as I possibly could. I was seeing a social worker at the time, and she was fully aware of what was going on, and so My friend came and got my son. And I had one more appointment before my spiritual weekend at the hotel. And so I went to see her, and I just, you know, I fell asleep on her couch waiting. She was with a patient. And when I woke up, I really believe that that was like that spiritual moment. And she was an angel in my life because she said, "Are you ready?" I wasn't quite sure what I was ready for, but I knew that I was ready to have those last, you know, 6 years. And my perception was just those 6 years. I was ready for that to change. And so she took me to a treatment center. And I am ever so grateful and blessed to have had that opportunity to spend 28 days in a treatment center. And I was so very, very ready to surrender. And I say that because if you're not ready to stop using drugs and alcohol, it's not going to get better. If you're not willing to surrender, as they say, there's the door. But I was ready, and I spent those 28 days where I learned about the program of Cocaine Anonymous. If anybody's done treatment, you know, back in the late 80s, they're very focused on eating disorders, which I didn't have, although I looked like I had one. You know, they were very focused on, you know, getting you into the 12 steps. And, you know, a lot of focus on trying to figure out what it was like and what happened. And it was a process for me. Because like I told you, everything I know about myself today is a direct result of working those 12 steps. And so it wasn't real clear to me what I had to do to get from here to here. So they told me when I got out to go to a meeting. Now how hard is that? I was like welcoming the opportunity. I'd been locked up in a house with the drapes drawn and spent 2 hours getting dressed for my first meeting. And it was my introduction back into civilization and socialization. And I sat in the back of the room and I couldn't figure out why you were laughing. Some of you were crying. Some of you were hugging and consoling each other. I couldn't, you know, these readings, what did they mean? And they told me to keep coming back. And I'm glad I did, because I learned about the program of recovery. And I learned about the 12 steps. Get a sponsor. Work the 12 steps. Go to meetings, work the 12 steps. Oh, and by the way, don't pick up the first one. So it happened as a result that first year. Yeah, needless to say, there was a divorce. There was some moving, you know, some disruption in my son's life, back into preschool and daycare, and I had to go back to work, and as Jamie was talking about, we are not alone, because all of you, the folks in the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous, were there to help me. I couldn't make a decision on my own. I put everything in the hands of, you know, at the time, my lawyer and my sponsor. And as a result of that, we made it through that first year and we moved on, you know. We had a few different moves, and but we made it through. And what happened is that continued journey that I'm ever so blessed with. You know, I make a joke about I've had a few sponsors and I've had a few husbands, but I've had one consistent entity in my life. Although I wasn't quick to acknowledge it and what it was doing for me, and being with me and walking with me was my higher power, my God and my understanding. You know, I grew up in a religion and in a church that, you know, was awesome. My dad, you know, sang in the choir. My mom taught Sunday school. You know, we were very active in Hales Corners, is where the Presbyterian church was. And so I absolutely believed, I almost romanticized something greater than myself. You know, my head was always in the clouds, but it talks about it in the big book that I have to have my feet firmly planted on the ground. And that's what the 12 steps taught me. And I learned to embrace the fact that I am not alone. You know, Jamie was absolutely right. You know, when things got tough, and of course, our perception of tough becomes our reality. And, you know, I had to be talked off the ledge more than once, because my God speaks through you people. As we go along this journey, you know, for me, I continue to rely on the people in this program, the friends and fellowship that I have, because you set examples for me. You know, when I'm in that place of indecision, I have to pause, pick up the phone, but more importantly, you know, I pray. You know, that friend I was talking to this morning, I was telling her, you know, the events of the last 16 months, some of them just recently this week, have created this thinking problem. You know, I'd be perfectly fine if I didn't think every day. I'd be perfectly fine if I didn't have to cross the path of all you, you know? And she said, you know, sometimes you just, you know, that prayer of praying for others and praying for a better outcome, and, you know, sometimes you just have to pray that you can let this go and not give something so much power. And so I really believe in the fellowship, and I believe in the friendship. Months ago, my son called me on a Sunday night and told me his father had died. Mind you, we'd been divorced, 25 years? And it was utter shock. You know, there was like these emotions could not connect to what happened. And I know that the journey that I took, I had to take it in the way I did, because I needed to be there to support my son and his other family. But I was also going through the fact that my mother was very ill, and we were struggling with that. And so, you know, if it weren't for the people in these rooms, for my higher power getting me through that, I truly, you know, I don't know where I would be. That desire to have that connection on a daily basis is so incredibly important. At some point, I realized how the father of my child was no longer with us. And, you know, I can speculate, and we've speculated, and, you know, he never stuck and stayed in the program. And, you know, there was times I would pray that the son of a bitch would get everything that was coming to him. And then there was days where I would just pray, you know, for him to have full abundance in life. You know, that was really all I could do. My mother passed away in September of last year. Probably the hardest thing I've ever endured. And although there's still sadness, obviously, I am so incredibly grateful that I could be there with her and hold her hand as she took her last breath. That my son, who grew up in this program until he was 10, because he started repeating things he was hearing at the meetings. That he was there. And there were so many people that shared similar feelings in these rooms that picked up the phone and called me and supported me. You know, I had some other, you know, ironically, last year in July, my son got married. And we welcomed Ashley into the family. And as happy and joyous as that was, there was a lot of turmoil because my mom was sick, and it was one of God's challenges, you know? Gaining a daughter-in-law, losing my son, my mother's not here, oh my gosh, you know? And once again, all of you were there for me. And our family has suffered some other losses, death, changes. Which brings me up to the current time where, you know, today, you know, because I choose to think and I choose to continue to have all of you in my life, there will continue to be challenges. The places and things I think are pretty easy for me. It's you people that I get challenged with. But you teach me, you know, love and tolerance of others is our code. In the last 15 years, I've been of service to Cocaine Anonymous in many, many service positions, and I'm so grateful for that. Service is action, and action is the magic word, and the action is that I need to change to continue to do what I'm doing. And every day is an opportunity for spiritual growth and for change, and I'm grateful to the people in these rooms who have helped me through that. So today, you know, I don't want to drink or drug. I don't want to pick up any mind or mood altering substance. This morning I didn't want to think. But this program has taught me how to, you know, show up and do what they do. You know, I get goosebumps during the sobriety countdown, always. And congratulations to all the double digits. Excuse me. But to this young lady, we say, keep coming back, it'll get better. And it's true. And even when it gets bad, it gets better because we're all here to help you to get through those life challenges. Today, I thanked God for the path he's chosen for me today. The challenges he's put in front of me. To let go, let God is tough some days. And that's the truth. I've been told to tell the truth. Trust the process. Today I'm grateful to be clean and sober. My anniversary date is January 5th, 1989. I plan to keep coming back. And so just to, you know, piggyback on Carmen, we are throwing a world convention in Chicago. Y'all have your hotel rooms. We're over 1,500 room nights at our hotel, which is awesome. We're way over our block. But we need to get y'all registered so we can all experience that moment when we're together and we're not alone. Again, thank you for allowing me to share tonight. thank you for letting me know that I'm not alone.